Haitians, Cubans, Venezuelans. Trump says we don't want them. A weatherman wants more honesty about federal cuts, and a mayor wants Florida to back off on immigration. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at President Trump's new travel bans and restrictions and the impact, if not the insult, it's registering in our Haitian, Venezuelan, and Cuban communities. We'll also talk with NBC6 meteorologist John Morales about his concerns that Trump's budget cuts could have weathermen like him flying blind this hurricane season. And we'll hear from South Miami Mayor Javier Fernandez about his suit to keep his cops out of immigration enforcement. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. This week wasn't going so well for President Trump. His one big beautiful spending bill was stalled in Congress. He broke up with Elon Musk. So he turned to the issue that always rescues him at such moments, immigration. Wednesday night, he announced travel bans and partial travel bans from 19 countries. Most are in Africa and Asia, but three are right next door, Haiti, Venezuela, and Cuba. The measures take effect on Monday. Trump's decree blocks new entry visas for Venezuelans and Cubans, but it imposes a total ban on Haitians visiting the U.S. Haitian American activist Pierre Imbert of Aventura heads the nonprofit IET Community Trust, which promotes development projects inside impoverished and gang-ravaged Haiti. Here's what he told me.
Tell me about the rational thinking of this thing, if we shouldn't be appealing to our friends in the United States government to understand the unfairness of this ban on 13 million Haitians. Your neighbor, a friendly country, a largely peaceful population, trying to maintain the lifeline between Haiti and the United States. This just cut off an important lifeline.
Trump insists he's protecting Americans from malevolent foreigners like the Egyptian man who attacked Jewish residents in Boulder, Colorado this week. He said that act
underscored the extreme dangers posed to our country by the entry of foreign nationals who are not properly vetted, as well as those who come here as temporary visitors and overstay their visas. We don't want them.
But critics call the move another xenophobic gesture aimed at rallying the president's MAGA voter base. What do you think it represents? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to talk about the impact this will have on South Florida's large expat community is Haitian American Marie Gerda Nicolas. She's a psychology professor at the University of Miami and is herself a leader of the IET Community Trust. She, in fact, just returned from a visit to Haiti last night. Also joining us is Adelis Ferro. She is a Democrat who heads the nonprofit Venezuelan American Caucus from Weston. Many thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you, Tim. Good to see you. Hi, Adi.
Hi, Gerda. Thank you, Tim.
Marie Gerda Nicolas, let me start with you, since this Trump travel ban will hit the Haitian community the hardest, obviously. We just heard Pierre Imbert say that this cuts off a lifeline for Haitians. What did you hear from Haitians themselves when you were in Haiti on Wednesday evening when President Trump made this announcement? Did they express much of the same thing?
Yeah, it was. Thank you so much, Tim, for having us. So there was really more, here we go again, right? Here we go again. Because whenever anything, this U.S. government wants to have international coverage, they mention IET. They do something related to IET and so on. So the larger message was, here we go again, you know, with IET, with targeting IET, with targeting Haitians in a particular way. So this is not new for us, right? Mm-hmm. But it is clear that every single time this happened, it has a huge impact. It has an impact on both Haitians that are in country in IET, and it has a huge impact on the, you know, over millions of Haitians who are residing in the United States as well and other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. And that lifeline aspect, how would you describe that, what Pierre Imbert was trying to get across in that notion of a lifeline?
Absolutely. I mean, beyond the personal stuff, because we have Many Haitians who are in Haiti who have family members who are here, and the opportunity to come and be connected to your family is cut off. So there's a huge psychological impact and mental health impact that is associated with that. But there's a huge economic impact, right, as well.
Yeah.
As you know, a lot of the things that we've been trying to do in Haiti is to focus on economic development, both on within country,
yeah,
like market-driven economies that allows for people to be able to sell their goods, both in country and outside of the
right.
And
I do want to get to that, Marigitte, but first, I also want to point out, you also pointed out to me yesterday, as you were returning from Haiti, that Trump's Haiti travel ban is based on what you call misinformation. For example, his administration's claim that too many Haitians were overstaying their visas. You say you've studied the data on these things, and you say they're just not true.
Absolutely, Tim. And I really, ask your viewers to really take a look at some of the claims, because when you, the data on the U.S. Department of Homeland Security provides annual entry and exit overstay reports. You know, and if you look at that report for 2023, Haiti is not even mentioning it. So mm-hmm. that's a claim that we don't have the data for it at all. The idea that there's an influx of unauthorized immigrant that came as a part of the Biden program is also false. So we know exactly the number of folks who came as a part of the Biden information, and that information is available.
But who came here legally? Under the humanitarian parole, for example.
Who came as a part of the humanitarian parole, right? So when we say that we have that Haitians pose a national security threat, and we use languages as like that there are criminal networks of Haitians that are created in the United States that makes us a threat to this country, there's also no data to back that up, right, as well. And so many of the claims, all four of the claims, right, that you are seeing in this document, there are no data to back it up, right? And that is dangerous. And that is unfair, and that is unjust.
But Adelis Ferro, we should probably point out here that President Trump used this week's case of the Egyptian man who confessed to that atrocity in Colorado and who did overstay his tourist visa as a central pretext for announcing the travel bans. Does the president make an understandable case in that regard, Ade, or not? As horrible as the crime in Colorado was, do Venezuelans here, for example, consider it a valid reason for these serious new restrictions that Trump is placing on Venezuelans and Cubans who travel to the U.S.?
Of course not. And what is very extraordinary is that that's the main reason he is alleged. That's the reason they are publishing this proclamation 24 hours ago. But then the person this country is coming, this criminal is coming from, which is Egypt, is not in the list.
Right.
Venezuelans, I again must say that we are not criminals. People in the United States and people that actually come with tourist visa, with business visas, and with student visas are people that want to do the things the right way. And actually, the fear is so real among our community that I can tell you that, for example, people entering the country for the last few years with a tourist visa are people that are treasuring those visas because it's so hard to get one.
Right.
So, no, I mean, our communities, and I think I'm talking not only about Venezuelans, but so many other communities that are on this list of this travel ban, we are not criminals. The reasons for this travel ban are way beyond these fake policies and it's some other.
Adelis, you expressed to me yesterday that you felt this presidential action is, quote, not immigration policy, it's white nationalism masquerading as immigration policy. Can you explain what you're getting at there?
Yes, of course. And I sustain it. I mean, what they are doing is, again, using this travel ban to coincidentally, and I am going to put quotes at the beginning and at the end of that word, just targeting Black people, brown people, Muslim people, and Asians, minorities, people from countries that are devastated for different reasons. And again, coincidentally, quote unquote, too, are the same countries they are trying to expel from the United States one way or another, either they do it legally or illegally. Mm-hmm. They don't care. They just don't want our immigration in this country, no matter how big our contributions are to this country.
Marie-Guerre de Nicolas, let me put that same question to you. As you pointed out earlier, the reasons President Trump puts forth for banning travel from Haiti look to be based on misinformation, if not, as you put it, ugly stereotypes. What then do you feel is the real reason he's cutting off all travel from Haiti to the U.S.? Do you agree with Adelis, for example, that this has racist undertones? What do you see as driving this at its core?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree with that. I think if you look to see what the list of countries that are being targeted, and it really is important that we take a look at this as a collective. It's not just about Venezuela or Haiti. It's about the totality of these countries that are being targeted and really take a look at the reasoning behind such targets overall. You know, Haiti has as the relationship. This let me remind the audience that this is the same country that this United States had Kenya go into Haiti as a way of handling the gang and
confronting the gangs that rule, right? Practically
exactly.
Rule the country today. Yeah,
right. Absolutely. But at the same time, cited that the reasoning for preventing Haitian nationals from coming into the country is because we don't have an infrastructure to be able to do so. So it would mean that you would have to agree that what you just did in this process of bringing Kenya to Haiti is not working, right? As well.
Right. No, as I recall, when the humanitarian parole program began, there was only one place in Haiti where Haitians could go to get their passports set up so that they could take advantage of the program. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Right. So these are the types of mechanism and things that are being done that makes you scratch your head to say, on the one hand, you said these are the things we need to do in order to ensure A, B, C, and D, or that Haiti is safe and that you're able to do business with Haiti. And on the other hand, you said, well, we can't do business with Haiti and we can't do business with Haitians, right? And so on. So you cannot help but think that there's a larger rationale, there's a larger reason for targeting Haiti when you even look at exactly what I did say, when you look to see other nations and so on, what's happening, and to put a total ban on IT nationals from traveling to this country is absurd.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Haitian community leader Marie-Guerre de Nicolas of the University of Miami and Venezuelan community leader Adelis Ferro of the Venezuelan American Caucus about President Trump's sweeping new travel bans and restrictions and their big impact on our expat community here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Adelis Ferro, Haiti is among the 12 countries facing Trump's total travel ban to the U.S., but Venezuela and Cuba are among the 7 countries looking at a partial ban, meaning more selective restrictions like a block on the issuance of new entry visas for Venezuelan and Cuban nationals starting Monday, as we pointed out. Can you help our listeners understand exactly what U.S. visa restrictions are now being imposed on those Venezuelans and Cubans?
Well, the first thing I should say is that for a change, these notices or proclamations or executive orders that they publish are always very confused. They are always not clear at all. So at this point, we are just waiting for Homeland Security to publish the way or the legal way that the notice with the protocol that Venezuelans and other countries have to follow in order to comply with this new travel ban. But as it is right now, there are very contradictory declarations. Actually, yesterday, the Spanish spokesperson from the Department of State said that non-Venezuelans are going to be able to come to the United States, even if they have a tourist visa granted before June 9, but now they are saying that probably yes. So at this point, Tim, it would be very irresponsible to say anything because they don't know it. I mean, they are contradicting each other with different statements. So we are just waiting for the actual notice from or Federal Register from Homeland Security to see exactly what is going on and what is going. But the experience that we have from 2017 is that even people that back then had a tourist visa, a valid tourist visa, and were able to get to the United States, many times were detained at the port of entry and their visas
Right.
were canceled on the spot.
And we should say 2017, you're referring to the travel
Talking back.
restrictions and travel ban and restrictions that President Trump tried to impose in his first presidency, so in that year. Marie-Gerde Nicolas, returning here to the total ban on Haitian travel to the U.S. going into effect Monday, when we look at the real on-the-ground effect this is going to have on the Haitian community, both in-country and over here in the diaspora, you mentioned earlier, and I want to go back to that, that Haitian economic development stands to take a big hit, particularly when it comes to the kind of work organizations like your IET Community Trust does in Haiti, which can involve Haitian entrepreneurs traveling here, no?
Absolutely. Let me give you an example, Tim, to be concrete. This is Caribbean Heritage Month, and we have a group of our colleagues with Danielle Saint-Lô and others who are slated to come to Florida to bring in from our designers to arts and crafts and so forth to be a part of this expo that is happening here in South Florida and in just a couple of weeks. To be able to come in and sell their material. These are organizations and individuals that we're supporting in IET. So this ban now prevents these folks from actually coming, right,
Right.
for this particular expo that is taking place in order for them to be able to sell their goods. When that happens, it means that the people that they're employing to do the work is also impacted. Right, as well in terms of economic development. So the larger effect, and immediately, because this ban takes an effect as of Monday, it has immediate ramification for many of our folks who are in small business, who are doing economic development work with the possibility of trade work, not
Right.
only in the US, but also in other parts of the world,
Right.
because the United States serve as a point of entry to connecting to other parts of the world as well.
Right.
So it
And
also
I should point out, Pierre Imbert was who we heard from earlier on that tape, was speaking to me from Boston at a conference for that very purpose, the exchange between Haitians here and Haitians there on how to promote development projects, business.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely, sir.
Adelis Ferrer, when it comes to the real life adverse impacts the Venezuelan and Cuban communities are likely to experience here from these new Trump travel restrictions on their home countries, you made the salient point to me yesterday that a large portion of the Venezuelan and Cuban communities resides here under immigration programs like asylum application, TPS, and humanitarian parole that often don't allow them to leave the U.S. They rely, you pointed out, on this back and forth travel between their countries and the U.S. to be able to see their family and loved ones. What sort of effect will this new presidential action have then in that regard?
The spreading of fear among my community and our communities, because families worry they will never see their loved one again, and community members fear that their legal protections, like TPS or parole, obviously are on the chopping block too. And then they don't even know what's going to happen with this once a year family reunification or family gatherings. There is a psychological damage too.
Right.
Remember. I mean, we have been already suffering through all of these immigrations decisions by the Trump administration, and now this one reinforced the idea that our presence is unwanted in the United States.
Right.
Ruling.
Adelis, I have to end things here. We're going to take a call from a listener, George from Boca Raton, who has something to say about this subject. George, in just the 30 seconds we have left, what do you have to offer here?
Well, I think that the motivation for the travel ban has to do more politically than anything else. I mean, Haiti's a failed state. We have bad relationships with Venezuela. I mean, I think it's more on that side than being racially motivated.
Okay. Well, thank you, George. We'll have to end things there. We want to say thank you to Marie-Gerde Nicolas, a Haitian American community leader and University of Miami psychology professor, Adelis Ferro, director of the Venezuelan American Caucus. Many thanks to you both. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Tim, for having us.
Thank you, Tim.
Still to come, a respected local TV weatherman speaks out about the cuts to the hurricane forecasting we'll get this year. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Last week, you may remember we devoted this program to preparation for the hurricane season that started just 6 days ago. We spoke with one of the National Hurricane Center forecasters here who's involved in the critically important work of tracking deadly storms as they approach us. And we, of course, discussed with him the hundreds of layoffs and the deep budget cuts President Trump has ordered at his agency and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, that oversees it. He told us things would be okay, but others aren't so sanguine. There are big fears that the NOAA staffing and funding cuts will compromise our hurricane safety this year. And this week, one local veteran TV weatherman, NBC6 meteorologist John Morales, has expressed those concerns on the air. Here, in fact, is part of what he told his viewers.
What we're starting to see is that the quality of the forecasts is becoming degraded. We may be flying blind, and we may not exactly know how strong a hurricane is before it reaches the coastline.
Do you share John Morales' concerns? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is South Florida NBC6 meteorologist John Morales. He's speaking to us from Nice, France, actually, where he's attending the UN Oceans Conference, which includes weather and climate. John, bonsoir. Many thanks for being with us from across the Atlantic.
Bonsoir, team.
Ça va? You are the longest-serving TV meteorologist in South Florida. The trust this community has in you is deep, to say the least. So, of course, I first wanted to ask you then, why? Why did you and NBC6 management, which you said encouraged you to make this on-air statement, decide to broadcast this warning, given how much what you say does matter here?
Well, first off, I mean, I had written about this in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, where I am a columnist generally on climate change, mm-hmm. but, you know, it did post twice on this issue beforehand. But indeed, I mean, this was my first opportunity on air in 2025 as NBC6's hurricane specialist. It's the first time I've been on TV this year, basically, right?
Right.
And indeed, producers asked me. They asked me at 4 o'clock to talk about rapid intensification cycles. And then they said, at 5 o'clock, we want you to talk about the federal cuts and what this means to your work. And I thought that the best way to do that, I know we'll talk about this in a little bit, mm-hmm. was to show the way I have been able to do my job over the last 34 years in South Florida media and what parts of that I may not be able to do this year. And I thought it was for the audience to understand how cuts to NOAA and the National Weather Service could very well cost lives.
Right. You opened that on-air statement with a past hurricane forecast, as a matter of fact, when we all thought Hurricane Dorian was going to slam into Florida after ravaging the Bahamas in 2019. And you confidently told the community, no, don't worry, it's going to turn north. And that's what happened. This week, however, you said, quote, "I'm here to tell you that I'm not sure I can do that this year." That's an unsettling message here. Again, why?
Well, because I feel it's true. So, you know, there's already statistics out there that show that the global models are not as accurate today as they were at the beginning of the year. And granted, you know, 4 or 5 months of data may not be enough to establish a long-term trend. We'll see if this actually continues. But the reason for that is very evident. You know, we're seeing where, for example, weather balloons are not being released with the normal frequency across the United States because there's not enough personnel at National Weather Service offices to be able to release the balloons, which importantly carry instruments known as radiosondes that mm-hmm. measure all kinds of meteorological elements as they rise into the stratosphere much more granularly than satellites can do. So, you know, there are some people out there saying, well, no, you know, we've got satellites. We don't need balloons. We do need balloons. And the forecasts are already being degraded. So I'm very concerned about that. And I think it'll impact our ability to accurately forecast, track, and intensity of tropical cyclones in the Atlantic this year.
You mentioned Hurricane Hunter flights, for example, too, right?
I did. And, that concern is quite acute, although I would say it's not something that's in evidence yet. Okay. It's something could potentially happen. So what am I concerned about? First of all, there are two mission specialists that were part of the cuts and layoffs done earlier in February because they were, of course, in their probationary period. And these meteorologists were basically fired. And now there's a hiring freeze, or there's been a hiring freeze in the National Weather Service. So we don't know how soon they're going to be replaced. Right. Without mission specialists, the hurricane hunters can't fly.
Okay.
You know how else they can't fly? They can't fly if the maintenance guys that are employed by NOAA to be able to maintain those aircraft, if there's a maintenance issue and the aircraft cannot fly, that's going to factor.
Right. Lots of nuts and bolts considerations there as well. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, well, I mean, I should clarify. The Air Force Reserve does have the 53rd Weather Squadron that flies into hurricanes too. It's not like we're losing all of the aircraft.
Okay.
But the NOAA aircraft are part of that, you know, it's almost like shift work. One plane goes in, the next one goes in, and on and on and on. And if the NOAA planes, there's three of them, if the NOAA planes can't fly, I am afraid that we're going to lose that data, which is crucial, and it's part of the reason that perhaps we may be surprised by a hurricane, which we thought was of X intensity and ends up being of Y intensity. And I think we'll talk about Hurricane Otis in that example as well.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, all this leads you to conclude in your statement that, quote, we may not know how strong a hurricane is before it reaches the coastline, as you said. That's quite a departure from the accolades we in the media have been pouring on the National Hurricane Forecasting Apparatus in recent years, how remarkably and precisely accurate their storm tracks and measurements have gotten. How big a setback to that achievement do you see this as being?
They are excellent, and we all admire the work that the National Hurricane Center does and their hurricane specialists, but they are not infallible. And there's two examples of forecast failures by the National Hurricane Center that were brought on not because these guys are not the best on the planet in forecasting hurricanes, but because they were indeed flying blind, mm-hmm. because they didn't have data from Hurricane Hunter aircraft. The examples are from the Eastern Pacific. Very specifically, I'll bring up the Otis example.
Sure. That was 2023.
The National Hurricane Center doesn't have planes flying in there nearly as often as we have in the Atlantic. They're trying to estimate the intensity of a hurricane based solely on satellite pictures. They underestimated the intensity of the hurricane. By the time the plane got there, it was a Cat 3 where they thought it was a Cat 1. It was going through a rapid intensification cycle. People in Acapulco, Mexico were preparing for either a strong tropical storm or a low-end Category 1, and they got slammed by a Category 5 because the forecast from the Hurricane Center was botched. And it was botched not because there's bad people there, but because there was no data there. And that's what I fear is potentially a possibility.
Right.
The Atlantic this year.
No, you're right. That is a great example to bring up. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with NBC6 meteorologist John Morales about the concerns raised for this hurricane season by President Trump's deep staffing and budget cuts to hurricane forecasting. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. John, in the larger picture, you called the federal cuts to NOAA and the National Weather Service a, quote, sledgehammer attack on science in general. Given your many decades as a meteorologist, what prompts you to make that assertion? And have you ever seen this kind of government, if not public backlash against science, rear its head in the course of your career?
No, I have not. And I should add for context for the audience to understand that I am also a trustee of Cornell University.
Okay.
And institutions of higher learning in this country are under assault right now. So when I tell you that science is being attacked with a sledgehammer, I am telling it to you not just because of my work in meteorology and what's being done to the National Hurricane Center and Weather Service and NOAA. I'm telling it to you from the angle of all the other scientific agencies that are being absolutely gutted right now, from NIH to U.S. Department of Agriculture, to so many others, and of course now to universities being defunded. We're moving away from the model that's been in place since World War II, where the federal government provides grants for universities to be able to come up with the latest things that can benefit society. You know, from science and new patents and new inventions to new drugs. You know, all the things that universities and their researchers can provide for our societal benefit are being blown to bits right now.
But John, when we say science in this context of our conversation, of course, we're talking largely about a backlash against climate science. Climate change and global warming are undoubtedly polarizing subjects in this country. So does it really come as a surprise to you, meteorologists, for example, such as yourself, that we'd eventually see this kind of, as you put it, sledgehammer attack on climate science under a second Trump administration?
Yeah, you know what's funny? The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change actually built in this type of scenario where there would be backlash in different governments around the world against these type of actions, you know, the type of actions that are required to be able to reduce greenhouse gases around the planet. And unfortunately, those scenarios, when they run them, point towards a much warmer planet, blowing well past 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius and getting to 3 or even 4 degrees Celsius, which, by the way, in this country I'm sitting in right now, France, they are preparing for 4 degrees Celsius by the year 2100 because, you know what, they know what's coming, right? Yeah. So am I surprised to see this? No. Project 2025 was, you know, very well publicized before the inauguration of the Trump regime. You know, even though he disassociated himself with Project 2025, they are following it to a T, and that included going of NOAA and the National Weather Service because, you know, they think that climate research is not important.
John, we have a caller here for you. Elizabeth in Pompano Beach has some input on this subject. Elizabeth, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hi, good afternoon, and I just want to thank Mr. Morales for his years of service. I'm a local resident, so tuned into him for a long time and depended on his forecasts. And I'm really dismayed that as we enter the thick of hurricane season and what's forecast to be a very difficult year, that the president has taken funds away from such an important service, but funneled them into a $45 million parade on his birthday. Just, it's dismaying, and it seems like the height of fiscal irresponsibility.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you very much for your call. John, along those lines, I mean, there was a little bit of politics there in Elizabeth's call. So I wanted to sort of shift here and ask you, do you worry that meteorologists like yourself and stations like NBC6 risk perhaps being accused of being, quote, political rather than scientific when you make public statements like this, especially when, as you did at the end of your on-air statement this week, you call on your viewers to call their representatives in Congress to, quote, make sure these cuts are stopped?
Well, stopping the cuts will save lives. Right. We know that every former director of the National Weather Service collectively wrote a piece that was published in the New York Times and many other outlets, fearing that lives will be unnecessarily lost in the year 2025 because of these cuts. So I don't see where that's political in any way, shape or form. In addition, everything I stated on air, you know, these cuts and the 17% less balloons and so on and so forth, it's all factual. Granted, and as I've explained here, you know, extrapolating how Hurricane Hunter flights are going to go this year, you know, might be a speculation, but I can tell you that fear is real. And there's, in my opinion, a pretty decent chance that some aircraft reconnaissance missions will go missing this year in the Atlantic because of what I've been telling you. I feel it was necessary.
Fair enough. John, finally then, in just the 30 seconds we have left, along those lines, does your on-air statement perhaps represent giving a voice to the federal hurricane forecasting experts who, because they are part of the government, maybe can't be as outspoken as you or I could be?
Absolutely. I've had conversations with many, many colleagues, and obviously they are in fear of repercussions of anything they might say. So you're going to hear them wishy-washily tell you that no, everything's going to be fine and whatnot. We have to be careful here. Again, this is a matter of livelihoods and potentially lives being ruined or taken because of the cuts, and that's why I'm so vocal about it.
John Morales, a South Florida NBC6's meteorologist. John, many thanks, and bon appetit.
Merci.
All right. Still to come, South Miami's mayor argues his police do not have to moonlight as immigration agents. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Few, if any, states have shown as much enthusiasm for aiding President Trump's sweeping drive to deport undocumented migrants as Florida has. And it's brought local law enforcement on board in droves. All 67 county sheriff's offices have now joined the so-called 287G program to assist federal immigration enforcement, and almost 250 municipal police forces have signed on. But one question hasn't been decided yet. Are local police departments actually, legally, obligated to sign on under state law? South Miami is saying no. And in fact, South Miami is the city that has filed the signature lawsuit challenging Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's assertion that local governments are compelled to aid the feds on immigration, and that those that don't risk being penalized as so-called sanctuary cities. It's a case brimming with important constitutional questions for Florida and the country. We'd like to know your opinion on those questions. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is the Democratic mayor of South Miami, Javier Fernandez. Mayor Fernandez, thanks for being with us.
Jim, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Tell us what the South Miami lawsuit is all about. What is it that you're essentially defying here in terms of state law and state orders when it comes to the question of compelling local governments and law enforcement to take part in federal immigration enforcement?
Yeah, so Tim, I would just take issue with the characterization of this as an act of defiance. What we're really trying to seek is a clarification of what the law requires.
Okay.
We read the law not to require us to blindly sign on to a 287 agreement. What we are reacting to is, frankly, what's been a coordinated pressure campaign by the DeSantis administration, led by his enforcement czar, immigration czar, and supported by the attorney general, or a local jurisdiction sign on to these agreements that, have significant financial and business impacts on jurisdictions potentially, and also can dramatically change the nature of law enforcement given this expanded role.
Right. Where do things stand with the suit now? What court is it in, and how has the state responded thus far? I know Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer, for example, has made motions to get it dismissed, right?
We filed a declaratory action in Leon County Circuit Court, which is a jurisdiction in which the governor and
in Tallahassee, right?
And the attorney general located. That was met in Tallahassee. That's correct. So the matter will be heard there. A motion to dismiss has been filed by the state, alleging that there's no immediate controversy that the court needs to decide. So they're trying to dismiss this on procedural grounds. But oddly enough, in their response, they got into a very detailed debate on the substance or the merits of the litigation. And I think their narrative is that the legislature has sought to expand immigration enforcement efforts. And I think, frankly, they mischaracterize what the legislature did in the most recent session. It bears noting that in this very session where they discussed immigration issues specifically, initially the proposal included a mandate for jurisdictions to sign 287G agreements and cooperate. And that mandate was removed. So clearly, we think the legislature contemplated this issue and chose the better course, which is not to require jurisdictions, but allow them to make their own decisions based on local needs,
right,
priorities, and impacts to those specific municipalities.
Mayor, did you also pursue this suit partly in response to what many felt was Attorney General Uthmeyer's strong-arming of the Fort Myers City Council when it came to this issue?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Our intention was merely to rescind, for most interlocal cooperation enforcement agreements, this could be characterized as such. We had a standing delegation of authority to our city manager, which allowed him to sign these agreements. And we were concerned that he would be put in harm's way, mm-hmm. given some of the threats that were being made of possible removal of administrative officers who did not execute such agreements. So we, as a board, were in the middle of debating rescinding that delegation and taking it back into the hands of the policy board, our commission, mm-hmm. when the letter was sent to Fort Myers. And that frankly is what changed the character of our discussion,
right,
and prompted us to file this action to kind of seek a safe harbor and ask a court, what is it exactly the law requires us to do?
Now, I know you mentioned to WLRN's Tom Hudson last month that your central concern here perhaps has less to do with immigration policy and more to do with sheer financial liability for your city. Explain exactly what that means.
Yeah, look, I've debated these immigration policy issues when I was a member of the State House, and frankly, it's not really the province of a city to focus on these issues. So setting the policy aside, really, when one reads the agreement on its face, the biggest concern I had as a lawyer, practice in private practice,
right,
and as the fiduciary board member of this municipal corporation, is the potential exposure it brings. You know, we've heard stories of American citizens being detained, arrested mistakenly. And frankly, our cooperating in these efforts under the agreement does not provide us any indemnification for our role in immigration enforcement. So potentially a small jurisdiction like mine with a budget of under $40 million could be spending tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and looking at millions of dollars of exposure should we participate and potentially detain someone wrongfully if they were to bring like a 1983 civil rights action against the city.
Civil rights litigation.
Correct.
Right.
And so without those kind of basic protections and guarantees, I thought it was premature just to blindly sign on. I thought these things should be studied, understood what the scope of our role would be, what the real exposure is. Mm-hmm. But what's happened over the last few months has been a coordinated campaign on the part of the governor to make it seem like we are the tip.
We seem to have lost Mayor Fernandez. Mayor Fernandez, are you there?
It looks like I got muted there for a second. My apologies.
Okay.
So we were, again, they're trying to form a narrative that Florida is at the forefront. And I understand it. Immigration is a problem. It needs to be addressed most appropriately at the federal level.
Right.
But we should all have the space to analyze, study, and make decisions rationally,
right,
not merely bending to one political ideology.
But this also, because you are a Democrat, this also brings up the question, how do you yourself feel about President Trump's migration deportation crusade? And are you and your South Miami police force on the same page here when it comes to challenging this idea of the states that you are compelled to help out the feds on immigration?
Well, look, we live in a representative democracy, and it's not the administrative officials that set policy for a city. It's the elected board members. So I start with that as my response to your question.
Right.
But personally, I mean, it's not about being a Democrat for me. It's about being the son of Cuban refugees, first and foremost, who came to this country, seeking a better future for themselves, trying to avoid the impacts of an oppressive regime, who overstayed their tourist visas, not because they wanted to defy American law, but because they just wanted to make a better life for themselves and their children until their status was adjusted by an act of Congress. So I come with that background first, mm-hmm. a background of empathy and understanding that most of the people we're talking about are good people, merely trying to make a better life for themselves. And so I fundamentally reject the rhetoric around immigrants being a net negative. I think Miami is emblematic of the contribution that a diaspora from all over Latin America and the Caribbean has had to the positive. And so I think, we would all be better served by having a conversation less focused on divisive rhetoric and one focus on what are the real economic needs mm-hmm. of the United States that should be served by a rational immigration policy.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with South Miami Mayor Javier Fernandez about his city's challenge to the state of Florida's assertion that local police forces are compelled to aid federal immigration authorities. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, Mayor Fernandez, aside from the more concrete concern you raised earlier about liability and exposure in potential civil rights suits, for example, there are larger constitutional questions that the South Miami lawsuit may serve to answer. The one that stands out to me is, while the U.S. Constitution says the federal government cannot compel the states to assume federal responsibilities, like immigration enforcement, can a state like Florida compel a local government like South Miami to take part in that work? Do you see South Miami as being sort of at the center of an important constitutional argument in that sense?
Yeah, no, I think there's an anti-commandeering question here.
Exactly.
That would be answered.
Yeah. Tenth Amendment stuff, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so can the state do what the federal government cannot, which is why these 287G agreements are styled as voluntary agreements, right? Mm-hmm. When one signs it with a jurisdiction. So those questions will certainly be answered, I think, in part by this litigation, if we get to the merits, which I suspect we will. And, you know, I think more fundamentally as a community, you know, we are seeing images of ICE enforcement actions all across the country. And I think it behooves local jurisdictions to ask themselves, what kind of relationship do we want to have with our communities? You know, ICE agents, when they're discharging their duties, are wearing masks because, yeah, as the head of ICE has said, you know, they want to forego some level of accountability. Does our involvement in this activity really change the nature and role and relationship with our local community? Yeah. And sometimes possibly for the worse.
You know, concern has been voiced in places like Coral Gables, et cetera, around South Florida.
And it is a fundamental concern because, you know, it is hard enough in the day-to-day course of police work to build a relationship of trust with the community. And so I think, you know, there are roles for every kind of agency. And I'm just asking, you know, I think we are asking, we'd like to have the space to have a conversation and not feel compelled, right, or our speech be circumscribed to ask, is this really in the best interests of our law enforcement mission locally?
But Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and his Attorney General, James Uthmeyer, argue, of course, that the state can compel a local government to take up the immigration enforcement task. And they claim that if you don't, you are by default declaring yourself a, quote, sanctuary city that illegally shelters undocumented migrants from the law. What's your response to their claim in that regard?
Well, look, I think, you know, I disagree that there is a mandate to sign these agreements in the law,
right,
today.
Mm-hmm.
Point, stop. There is no mandate. And again, I think the legislative history very clearly supports that position. Now, that said, we do cooperate, you know, in providing information and other resources to federal authorities when we are asked, right? But that's very different than actually discharging the mission as a frontline operative, right? Providing support for that mission to ICE in the background, information, logistical support, et cetera, all things that we already do. But being the actual enforcers of that law, I think fundamentally changes the character of our local policing. And I think with it should bring some concerns about whether that the change in character actually serves our local municipal safety concerns, you know, in the best way possible.
Mayor Fernandez, in just the minute we have left here, you're a Democrat, but also, as you pointed out, a Cuban American. And so I also wanted to ask you about a complaint you directed recently at South Florida's largely Republican Cuban-American leadership, including Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Miami-Dade County's congressional delegation. As a son of Cuban refugees, you recently questioned their commitment to immigrants in this community. Why? What was the point that you were trying to make there? And again, we only have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I don't know that I've made that statement, but I will say, I think, you know, we're 25 years on the anniversary of Ileana Gonzalez episode here in Miami. And I think what we were fighting so hard for in that particular case was due process, an opportunity for that young boy to get a hearing on whether or not he should be able to remain in the United States. And I just urge my colleagues at the federal level, right, to remember what we were fighting for then, because in okay, many circles in Washington, we're talking about circumscribing.
Mayor Fernandez, unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there for time. I apologize. Javier Fernandez is mayor of South Miami. Mayor Fernandez, many thanks for your time. We appreciate
it. Tim, have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
And now, here's Sophia.
Fine, and it won't up.
You heard the young lady. Finally on the roundup, we'd like to introduce Sophia Usta. She's 2 years old, and she's a future radio host we're mentoring here at WLRN. You see, Sophia is a big fan of WLRN news anchor Helen Acevedo, whose newscast voice you hear every afternoon.
From the WLRN newsroom, I'm Helen Acevedo.
Sophia's parents, Joseph and Adriana Usta of Parkland, listen to WLRN in the house a lot, and they sent us this video of Sophia replicating Helen's signature sign-on.
This is Helen Acevedo.
We here at WLRN can't ignore that kind of talent and dedication in a budding broadcast journalist, so we asked Sophia to help us close today's show.
I wonder if a South Florida Roundup.
That was Sophia Usta, and that will do it for the South Florida Roundup. And you better watch out, Mary Louise Kelly. We also want to wish our Muslim friends Eid Mubarak. If you missed any part of today's show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's shows. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.